Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half hour featuring unique personalities whose ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers Newark. And now, Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Annette Gordon-Reed is an authority on the intimate relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, a slave on his Virginia plantation with whom he bore 7 children. She wrote a definitive book on that relationship in 1997, creating a storm of controversy from those who refused to believe that Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence and the 3rd President of the United States, would have a 38-year love affair with a slave. She's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Annette Gordon-Reed is a professor of law at Harvard University. Welcome to WBGO.
Glad to be here. Glad for having me here.
When we first spoke, you indicated that your work on the relationship between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson caused quite a furor, and I'd sort of like to go back to that, to those days.
Okay.
Tell us, what happened?
Well, when I first wrote the book, I would have to say that many members of the public were not as concerned about it. There were members of his family and people who were supporters, what they call themselves supporters of his family, his legal white family, who were quite concerned about it as well, thinking that it was something that was out of character for Jefferson, and also relying on the works of historians who had written about the subject. So it was one of these kinds of things where there was a conventional wisdom about the subject, and my first book sought to overturn that.
Even Joseph Ellis, who won a National Book Award for the biography, a book called The American Sphinx, said that Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson never were intimate. That must have been tough to take.
Well, it was. That was his judgment at the moment. I mean, he has changed his mind about that, but this was before the DNA test that corroborated this. He went along with the idea that it was sort of out of Jefferson's character to have done something like that. There were people who felt that Jefferson was too racist to have been involved with a person of color, but of course, lots of racist people had sex with black people. Racism didn't preclude that. So that was basically his judgment, and to his great credit, he has turned around on that subject.
And he said that Jefferson had lived a lie.
Mm-hmm.
That was really pretty tough for him to say. There were hints, by the way, that relationship long before you ended the debate. Back in 1802, there were stories in a Richmond newspaper about that.
Yes, and actually, even before then, Jefferson's neighbors gossiped about this. But during the course of Jefferson's first term as president, obviously people who wished him ill sought to use the story as a way of hurting him. But it actually didn't turn out that way. He was reelected resoundingly in 1804.
Going back to Thomas Jefferson, Randolph, a grandson of Thomas Jefferson, told Jefferson biographer Henry Randall at as far back as 1868 that Hemings' children resembled Mr. Jefferson so closely that it was plain that they had his blood in the veins.
Yes, yes. But he said it was the blood from someone else, namely Jefferson's nephews, his sister's children, one of the sons of his sisters. It was not the kind of thing that you could blame on, or blame, if you want to use that term, say that it was sort of visitors, you know, strangers to the plantation who fathered the kids, because the kids all looked like him. And so they picked relatives, but they ended up picking the wrong ones.
Why? Why did you do all this?
Well, I was concerned about the way black people were portrayed in history. It was not so much the idea that Jefferson had an affair with an enslaved woman, because that was actually a common thing to have happen. But it bothered me that historians were not paying attention to the words of people who were enslaved. Typically,
those are oral history, was it not?
Well, except Madison Hemings, oral history usually refers to descendants of people who are telling their family stories, you know, back through the generations. But Madison Hemings, his recollections were actually, you know, he's a first person account. He actually lived at Monticello, so he was there. So it's not properly oral history, but it was really.
We're talking about the sons of Sally Hemings.
But it was really this idea that slave owners were people who could be trusted, and slaves were the ones who you had to be wary of, which I thought sort of turned the world upside down in a way.
When did you first decide that you wanted to investigate, unravel Thomas Jefferson's life?
Well, I've been interested in Jefferson since I was in elementary school.
In Conroe, Texas.
And I was interested in someone who liked to read books, who wanted to find out about the world, and I liked that kind of thing myself. I was interested by the idea that he wrote the Declaration of Independence, but also had slaves, so that contradiction made him seem a fascinating person to me.
Were you angry about that? As a child? As an African-American child? Actually, at that point, I think you were in an all-white school, were you not?
Well, pretty much all-white school. I had integrated our school district when I was in the first grade. By the time I was in the third grade when I started reading about Jefferson, there were a few more blacks there at that time period, but I was drastically outnumbered, I could say. I felt not anger so much as sadness. I felt sorry for people who were living under those kinds of conditions and wanted to find out as much about them as I could.
Did you identify with her, with Sally Hemings? Actually, Elizabeth Hemings, if you go all the way back, and you made me do that.
Yeah,
book,
I made you do that. Yeah, all the way back to 1735,
I'm
yes.
I'm going to blame you for that.
The matriarch of the family, Sally Hemings' mother, Elizabeth, born in 1735. Did I identify with them? I identify to a certain degree. I mean, because I know that my ancestors were enslaved in Texas. So there's that connection that will always be there. I mean, they led a different life from most enslaved people, but they were still slaves. So that connection is definitely there for me.
An African-American woman way back in Virginia during the 1750, 1750, 1750. Mm-hmm. If you'd lived back there, you'd have been a slave.
Absolutely. I remember being in school one time and one of my teachers was saying, oh, wouldn't it have been great to live back at that time period? She's sort of waxing nostalgic about, you know, the clothes and the dress. And I said, no, because I would have been a slave. And that's the way I felt about it. I can't, it's hard for me to join in with the nostalgia for the 18th and the 19th century.
I remember you once told me that recently that it's difficult for an African-American to write about white families, but though it's always been accepted to have white writers write about African-Americans.
Exactly.
Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think there's a sense that whites are defined as the norm, so whites can be objective, and which is what you strive for in history. You never get that completely, but you're striving for that. And there's a sense that black people will always be partial or self-interested, and that we can't be scholarly and detached. And so if I'm writing about white people, my anger at white people will come through, or I will lack the kind of objectivity that's required, or that you, as I said, that you strive for in writing history. And so, you know, people don't think of whiteness as a race. You know, it's sort of, or an interest group. It's just sort of the norm in America because so many more people are white. And blacks are seen as an interest group. So there's a sense that I'm not qualified to write about a white person in a way. It's going to be interesting. I want to do a biography of Jefferson. So it'll be interesting to see how that is received when I write about him, not just in topics involving race and slavery, but about politics and all of his life in general. So we'll see.
How do people react to you now?
Very positively, I have to say. I mean, it's been much better than I thought it was going to be.
Did you think it was going to be?
I thought people might be more hostile. I think the people who are hostile write to one another, or they write to other people about me. But as a general rule, I've had some problems in the past with people, and in fact have sort of removed all of my contact information off of things. But just in general, people have been pretty positive.
What kind of problems did you have?
Well, I probably shouldn't talk about it.
Oh, sure, absolutely. NPR, we always talk about it.
Talk about
like
it. I don't know if the police would want me to talk about it. I mean, people who have been hostile.
Would you be a little more informative than that?
No, other than to say that I've removed all of my contact information from things because of issues.
Threats?
Yes.
What kind of threats?
Well, no. No, let's not talk about it.
But it's hard to deal with.
Well, not as hard to deal. I mean, I am just sort of wary about things, and we're very careful about stuff.
Being you and your husband.
Yeah, me and my husband, and yes.
How do your children deal with this crazed mom who spends 10 or 11 hours a day trying to unravel an entire life of a man who's revered and who still is has people saying this is not true, it's not true, it can't be true?
Well, I divide my time between my children, my family, and my work. Right now that I've finished the book, I don't have, you know, huge amounts of time, but much more time than I had when I was working on the book. They took it in stride. I mean, I would try to, you know, I'd come home and do things with them and hang out with them, and I spent, you know, a good amount of time with them. But they understand that it's something that that's very meaningful to me, and I think it has worked out pretty well.
What do they want to know about Thomas Jefferson? It's all over your house, I assume. There must be loads and loads of files and documents. It's bad enough to read every endnote that you've ever put in this.
Well, what do they want to know about Thomas Jefferson?
What have you told them?
Well, my daughter read the first book. They have not read the second book. I guess they are sort of surprised by the idea that neither of them are history buffs. My son is a film buff. And he has the same kind of intensity about about movies in general. So he gets the premise of being interested in things in that way. I think that they're more interested in, you know, the why of being a historian rather than, you know, just Jefferson.
Don't they care about their heritage a little bit? I mean, you're opening up an immense can of worms.
Oh, they care about their heritage, but my daughter I think they're much more interested in, you know, current events than the 18th century. That's it's a special person to be interested in the 18th century, you know.
You're listening to your Conversations with Alan Wolper. Our guest this time is Annette Gordon-Reed of Harvard University. She was a former professor of history at Rutgers Newark University and a professor of law of New York Law School. She is the author of The Hemingses of Monticello, a biography of Thomas Jefferson, which won the National Book Award as well as the Pulitzer Prize. When you first started, way, way back, you started your life back in Conroe, Texas, which is not exactly in America's easiest place to live. Your father was, didn't he own a funeral home store? Your mother was teaching in the 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
There you were, an African-American student. You go to kindergarten, and then all of a sudden, in the first grade, they say, now you're going to go to that all-white school. What happened when the first day you walked in? What was that like?
Well, I can't say I remember the first exact day. I remember the first week, the first period of time. My first memory of that, my father took me to school. There was an agreement with the school officials that if my parents didn't make a big deal about this, which they didn't want to do it anyway, I mean, to go to the newspaper or anything like that, they would make sure that everything was pretty much handled, in a very low-key fashion. It was not like mobs of people screaming at me or anything like that. I think that there were threats to my parents that I didn't find out about until later on. But it was a pretty calm scene. The teachers were very, very supportive and made sure that everything worked smoothly. They're still duking it out. We're still fighting that out. There were people who came to the classroom. I mean, there would be these sort of delegations of people who would kind of show up and stand in the doorway and look. It's sort of like, so I had a sense of being on display because
white.
I was on display.
They were white?
Yeah. I mean, these are, you know, school officials, people to see, you know, just how is this working, essentially? How is this going to go on? So there was always, I mean, I always had an early on a sense of being on display. But for the most part, as I said, the teachers were, well, all the teachers were uniformly wonderful to me. The students, not so much. There were people whose parents had clearly told them to make sure they played with me, and there were people whose parents told them, you know, or didn't tell them, but I mean, who'd gotten a cue that they were supposed to be hostile. So I learned early on that there were different types, that not all white people were the same, or didn't have all the, you know, didn't have the same values from that experience, which was tough. I broke out in hives, my mother said. At one
hives?
Point. Hives, you know, like a rash from
stress. From stress. Well, yeah. What do the kids do? I mean, what were the positives that you recall, and what were the negatives?
Well, the positives, I remember one family that, I mean, Conroe, the schools, the people came in from all different little towns in the area. And I remember one family that was very, very poor. And I could tell they were poor because their mother had gotten some material or something, and they all had on the same, she'd sewn them all the same kind of dress from the same material. And they would always, if they were playing Red Rover or Ring Around the Rosie or something like that, they would always, because they always come over and get me and have me play with them. So that was a good stuff. Anytime you're a kid and you're included in those kinds of games, that's a good thing, no matter what race you are, obviously. The bad things, you know, name calling, that kind of stuff, you know, nigger, whatever. And those kinds of things were hurtful. But that wasn't the main experience. The main experience was people either being just sort of neutral or people being sort of affirmatively helpful, and with a smaller group of folks who were hostile.
I spoke last night to the city editor of the Conroe Courier.
It's amazing.
Well, that's what the job is, right?
Well, you're supposed to call you up,
check you out.
Yeah, check the stuff out.
Because isn't that where you started your life as a writer? Back when you were 16 years old? How'd that happen? Tell us.
Well, I had thought
of myself. By the way, I should say everybody that the Conroe Courier has a circulation of 11,000, and they're proud of it.
Okay, they're very proud of it. I, you know, had always thought of myself as a writer. When I was smaller, I would write, you know, little books with chapters and stuff in it. And this was an era of around the time of Watergate, and journalists were heroes at this point. And I knew I wanted to do something in terms of writing. I'd always loved history. I thought about that. But I thought journalism might be something to go into. And I wanted a job, but I didn't really think I didn't want to work at, you know, a fast food place or anything like that. And I'd heard that there was a job opening for an assistant at the Conroe Courier to a woman named Beverly Narum, who, you know, had recently come to Conroe, and she'd been at some other paper in Texas. And so I applied for the job, and I got the job. So that was my first job.
Were you the only African-American on the staff at that time?
Curious. On the staff. That's somewhat exalted.
Right.
I worked after the hour, a couple of hours after school. Yeah, I guess I would be the only, I was the only black person there at the time, staff or not.
What'd you write about, you remember?
I was on the society page. People would write in about their parties and their weddings and their engagement things. It was my job to turn it into something that could be in the Conroe Courier.
So you're already starting to deal with roots way back then.
Exactly.
By the way, for those of you who are listening, I want you to know that you are listening to Annette Gordon-Reed, the author of The Hemingses of Monticello. By the way, the subhead is An American Family. It's a little ironic. And she's with us to talk about her book and her investigation of Thomas Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings, a slave on his Virginia plantation, with whom he bore 7 children. Now, you have a whole bunch of people who you idolized or you followed. You told me, let's see, I'll make sure I get this right, Sinclair Lewis, James Baldwin, Ernest Hemingway. That's really across the spectrum, isn't it?
Yes. Well, really, I became, as I said, someone who had fantasies of being a writer of some type. I started reading novels in high school, novels that I should probably go back and read now, and I would really understand what they were about. But I also started reading, developed the habit of reading biographies about the writers with whom I was, you know, that I was reading at the time. Sinclair Lewis, James Baldwin. James Baldwin was sort of, very, very important to me. Gore Vidal also was someone whose work I admired. Burr.
Why James Baldwin?
James Baldwin, to me, because he's the first black writer who had the kind of life that was more akin to the life of a writer, not just a black writer. In other words, he wrote essays. He wrote in Esquire. He was given, and he wrote novels. And so he had a wide range of, he wrote about race quite a bit, but he wrote about it in a lot of venues, is what I'm meaning. He had sort of a, you know, romantic life, and he was an expatriate in Paris and
in Istanbul,
you know,
and places
like
that.
Yes, things like that.
Hemingway has had to go through a lot in his life and in his death about whether he was a racist or not.
Mm-hmm.
Found that interesting.
Well, you know, there were, racism was a part of the currency of American life at that time. Fitzgerald, all of those people, I remember reading his, reading about his diaries that were published. And there were all these sort of statements that are, you know, anti-Semitic, anti-Black as well. But he was a gorgeous writer. I mean, he wrote very, very well. And so there's always this tension for Black people when you're, you know that the people who are producing this material may not be your friend in a way, but they're doing something that is, that's unmistakably great as writers. And so there's always that weirdness there. How do you, you can't say, I'm not going to read Fitzgerald, I'm not going to read Hemingway, I'm not going to read these things because of how these people who are no longer here may have felt, because they didn't want to be your friend or whatever.
Was there a particular book you liked with from Hemingway, by Hemingway?
For Whom the Bells Tolls. I also like A Movable Feast. He did a Movable Feast.
Not many people like that.
I know, but it's interesting. I know, not people, but it's quirky. It's different. It's a different kind of book. And it's a different voice for him. It's a gossipy voice, and I like that.
Sinclair Lewis, Main Street, huh? Mm-hmm. Why Sinclair Lewis?
Well, I don't, you know, it's interesting because, as we were saying, I mentioned before, he's sort of fallen out of favor now. People find him not, well, I want to say pedestrian, that his work hasn't held up. Although a couple of years ago, there was someone who was trying to get a revival of Sinclair Lewis, but he wrote about American life, a critic of American life and sort of American middle class life. And he had a sharp eye for that kind of thing. And he was also a writer activist, which was also attractive to me. And he knew, and from reading about him, I, you know, started reading about H.G. Wells, some of the people that he associated with. So it was, I think his work and his life both interested me.
I'm curious, was reading all these people and their roots, did that lead to Jefferson want you to know more and more about Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson?
Well, certainly, I think, I mean, I never lost the interest in Jefferson. All the time that I was reading these other people, I was still reading about him. I do think this process of researching the lives of other people stood me in good stead when I started to work seriously in sort of writing books about Jefferson. Because by the time I started doing that, I was accustomed to learning how to piece together conflicting stories. I mean, if you read, say, a biography of Hemingway, they will have one view about him. You read a biography of Fitzgerald, there'll be a completely different view about Hemingway because they were somewhat rivals. And I think there was a time period when I could have written a pretty good book about literary feuds just from seeing the different perspectives that people, that biographers brought to their subjects. And so I think that really helped me when I started working on this book.
Did you know when you finished your first book, going way back 11, was it 11 years, I
mm-hmm.
guess?
Yeah, wow.
What was going to happen then? I mean, would you anticipate like an uproar?
Because
I don't think you could have written this book 20 years ago.
No, I don't think so. Yes, I did anticipate an uproar, but it didn't come the way I expected. As I said, there were pockets of resistance, but I also didn't expect that there would be, you know, DNA tests the next year. Which
I just was trying to
along.
Read this DNA test. Do you understand it? I mean, what exactly happened? I mean, I'm still reading it.
Uh-huh.
And the Thomas Jefferson Foundation then, I think in 2000, formed a commission to try to check out the DNA of the DNA, right? It was just really confusing. There was a minority report.
Well, the basic point is that,
yeah,
and it is somewhat confusing.
Good. I don't feel so bad.
No, I don't feel so bad. It is kind of confusing. The Jefferson family, as I'd mentioned before, had said that the reason Sally Hemings' children looked exactly like Thomas Jefferson is that they were the sons, they were the children of his sister's son, a man named Carr. Now, males, you and your father, and if you have any brothers, all the males in the audience have a Y chromosome. And that Y chromosome passes down from father to son intact, generation to generation. Yours is the same as your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather's was. And so you can tell a male family line from the Y chromosome. You can separate out a Jefferson Y chromosome from a Carr and so forth and so
where
on.
Where do you find that?
Pardon me?
Where do you find that chromosome? How do you...
Well, you draw people's blood and they drew the blood of Jefferson, one of Jefferson's, a member of the Jefferson family, I think five of them, a member of the Hemings family, a member of the Carr family, and a member of another family that claimed descent from Jefferson. And they sent it off to three different schools, and they did differing testing methods to determine who was matched up. And all three of them came back the same.
And you didn't know this was going on at the time?
Well, I knew it was going to go on. I mean, someone, after my book came out, someone came to one of my talks, and she told me that they were going to do it. So I kind of sat there for a year waiting for the results.
Like a verdict.
Exactly. I mean, it was somewhat nerve-wracking. I was pretty certain what was going to happen, but you never know. You know, you never know 100% certainty anything. So, yeah, and the results came back and said that the Hemings and the Jefferson person were linked, and the Carr family was totally out of the picture. So it's not a straight paternity test, but what it does is it corroborates the connection between Hemings and Jefferson.
Wow, that's...
Doesn't happen very often in history.
No. I mean, that DNA is changing history. Will totally change history.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Annette, we've spoken a lot about what it was like to grow up in Conroe, Texas, a town that once welcomed the Ku Klux Klan. But there was one particular case in Conroe that I've became very interested in and that we've spoken about, one that showed just how racist that town could be. It spoke about law enforcement and how the law was sometimes twisted to go after someone just because he happened to be black. Tell us a little bit about it.
This Charles Brantley was a black janitor at Conroe High School where I graduated. He was accused of raping and killing a girl in the school there. And, you know, a book has been written about this, which I have not read. And it was just a sensational trial because there were so many irregularities in the way the evidence was handled and so forth, and it kind of brought back memories of the things that, you know, the terrible things that happened in this town. There was a man who was burned on the courthouse square in my hometown in the 1920s. One of my grandmothers refused to spend the night in Conroe because it had such a terrible reputation for, you know, the Klan activity and lynchings. And indeed, one of my brother's friends was killed, a young man, when he was about 15 or 16 years old. He'd been picked up, taken to the police station, and the next morning he was dead, you know, and nothing ever happened. No, there was no investigation, nobody ever. So those kinds of things color the way people viewed the Brantley trial because it had such a terrible, Conroe has had such a terrible history of racial problems.
Maintenance men was white, and one of them was black. He turned to the black one and says, "Okay, nigger, that's you."
Yeah.
And took him away.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that doesn't surprise me. That was the way things were in the town.
I want to thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Pulitzer Prize winning author Annette Gordon Reed. We'd love to hear what you have to say about our program. You could write to me at Conversations with Alan Walper at WBGO 54 Park Place, Newark, New Jersey 07102, or write to my email, alanwalper@msn.com. You can find all of our other podcasts at wbgo.org/Walper. That's wbgo.org/Walper. The brains behind this operation include Joanna Walper, who's the senior producer. Doug Doyle is the news director. And until the next time, I'm Alan Walper.